Hello and welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. I'm Craig DL, I'm the Head of Policy and Research at Commonweal. And this week, I'm joined by Ros Foyer, the General Secretary of the Scottish Trade Unions Congress, better known as STUC. Welcome to the show. Hi, thank you for coming on.
Hi, Craig.
Yeah. Now, trade unionism and the fight for workers' rights has had a long and proud history in Scotland. It's one that Commonweal has and will strongly support whenever we can. However, it's fair to say those rights have faced a constant struggle, and the very nature of work itself has changed over the past few decades. So we're going to discuss what that has meant for workers, what that has meant for workers' rights, and what it means for trade unions. So, Ros, we'll start off. Who are STUC? What do you do? And how did you become involved in trade unionism?
Okay, well, the STUC is Scotland's Trade Union Centre, and what we do is we coordinate and develop and articulate the views and the policies of the whole trade union movement across Scotland, and an attempt to reflect the aspirations of trade unionists as workers, but also as citizens. So that involves a lot of lobbying and campaigning. And I mean, we want to try and be a very strong and influential and globally aware trade union centre. We want to champion equalities, and really what we're trying to deliver is a fundamental shift in wealth, well-being and power towards workers, our families and our communities. And I guess if I'm just thinking about it, the way that we go about doing that, it is about supporting our affiliates to educate, agitate and organise and build a really strong and really diverse trade union movement that can bring about that change.
Now, interesting you used the word agitate there, because one stereotype that often comes to mind when you talk about trade unions is quite an old-fashioned one of a bunch of angry men, it usually was men, on a shop floor somewhere, shouting at managers and generally having this very adversarial relationship between the union and the management. Is that a kind of fair stereotype? Was that ever a fair stereotype? And how has that model of trade unionism changed over the course of the past several decades, really?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it very much is a stereotype, and, you know, it's a hard stereotype, I think, being honest, for the trade union movement sometimes to get away from, similar to the sort of stereotypes of, you know, oh, did trade unionism not die out when Thatcher came in and, you know, crushed the miners and things like that. So there's a range of stereotypes that trade unions have to contend with, unfortunately. But the reality is that actually we're an extremely diverse movement. We have members and leaders, who are a very diverse bunch these days, in all different parts of the economy. And we have a lot more women leaders, leaders from the BAME community, a much more diverse range of leaders. And when I talk about leaders, I'm talking about reps in workplaces. I'm talking about people who are branch secretaries and people at different levels right throughout the trade union movement. Now, that doesn't mean that we're any less misogynistic than any other parts of society, or that we don't still have, you know, struggles that we need to meet or do a lot better to become more diverse. But I think that the old sort of model of what a trade union is like misses the point. There are reps out there every day who work really collaboratively with employers, who bring a lot to the table in terms of helping to increase innovation and productivity, and who are fighting, you know, and winning small battles every day on behalf of their members to make their workplaces much more inclusive and high quality places to work. So, you know, that's not to say there isn't times when an adversarial approach is needed. And, you know, we're certainly not shying away from adopting that approach when and where necessary, because unfortunately there still are some employers out there who are not treating workers appropriately and have not become enlightened to the fact that that's the best way to treat your workforce.
Actually, just before I started this interview with you, I got an email in from the Scottish Left Review saying that you were going to be speaking at an event on the role of women within trade unionism. So if anyone's interested in that, I'll stick a link to that event in the description of the podcast.
Yeah, that would be great. Thanks, Craig, because I do think that, you know, women are still in a very, very difficult position within the labour market. We're often in areas that there are still huge structural discriminations and issues to be dealt with around pay and how women's work's valued. So for me, that's where some of the key battles ahead are going to come in our movement.
And you did say you're not shy of going for that adversarial approach when necessary, and it certainly has its place. But is there also space for a more constructive and cooperative arrangement between unions and employers?
Yeah, there definitely is, and 99.9% of the engagements that happen day in, day out, week in, week out, between union reps and their employers are really constructive. It's about finding solutions. It's about employers working with unions to consult the workforce to get the best solutions to issues that they're facing. It's about putting good ideas on the table, and it's about, you know, working things through and feeling your way forward and consulting your workforce about how best to get around issues that people are facing. But, you know, sometimes there is a need for workers to come together and to challenge their employer. And that's where a trade union can give that collective power in a way that, you know, sometimes individuals just don't feel they have the power to challenge certain situations.
Yeah. Now, along with that old-fashioned stereotype of the trade union, it's fundamentally linked to an old-fashioned stereotype of work where you would enter a particular company. It would be a job for life within that company. You might move around within the company, but that was you from apprenticeship to retirement. Work is a lot more precarious now than it used to be. Folk often voluntarily move jobs more readily. I mean, I have personal experience of that, moving from the field of laser physics into the field of politics. I can't imagine a bigger jump, really. But folk are also pulled into the, you know, very precarious work in the shape of the gig economy, with 0-hour contracts and very limited workers' rights, and even the denial of the status of employee. How has this affected workers' rights, and how have unions tried to adapt themselves into helping people who are in these situations?
Well, there's no doubt that work has changed, and that, you know, the sort of neoliberal model of economics has had a really pretty bad impact on workers and workers' rights. If you look at the post-war era and, you know, look to some of the rights that parents and grandparents enjoyed, and, you know, there was that feeling that work was going to become a better place, the working week was going to get shorter, you could rely on having an income that would give you a decent standard of living and a pension at the end of your employment and all of those things. Unfortunately, we have seen a lot of privatisation, a lot of anti-union laws being brought in. We've seen an increase in precarious work and the use of things like 0-hour contracts, agency labour, a whole range of very difficult employment practices that have helped to really, you know, split workers up and isolate them in a lot of ways and not give them the confidence to get unionised. We've also got things like, casual work has always been there. The gig economy, if you ask the musicians union or unions like, you know, the broadcast and entertainment and theatre union, they'll tell you that, you know, the gig economy is not a new thing. But what's new is the sort of digitalised platform gig economy, where your supervisor is faceless, there is zero accountability, you're given your jobs for the day through an app, for example, you're measured in algorithms and, you're measured to a degree that most workers wouldn't have dreamt of a couple of decades ago in terms of your work outputs, etc., etc. You've got no way of knowing what other employees are getting paid for doing the same sort of work, so that pay transparency, all of these control issues are really very well hidden by employers, and you might not even know who your colleagues are to be able to collect advice with them or organise yourself. Similarly, with the increase in home working, it's very difficult for union organisers to go and talk to people, or union reps for that matter, to talk to potential members about joining the union if everyone's working from home. So these are all really big, really tangible issues that our movement has to face in the period ahead going forward. I guess the good news is that organising even in these environments can be done and has been done. So we've seen, organisations like Better Than Zero that's supported by the STUC operating really effectively in the hospitality sector. We've seen unions like Unite organising workers who work offshore and effectively undertake zero-hour contracts, and they're in, all sorts of different oil and gas installations offshore. We've seen home carers being organised by unions like Unison and the GMB. So it can be done, but it takes a lot of effort and innovation. And we really need to keep up with our use of technology and educate workers and think about issues like data protection and, all of that as we move forward. So it is definitely an area that we're highly aware of, we're focused on, and the STUC's collaborated internationally to share best practice on some of these issues, because that's really a big part of us supporting our affiliates to operate in this new landscape.
And when you talk about that app-based working, it reminded me of a policy paper that Commonweal published a few years ago looking at the rise of automation and other disruptive technologies. It occurs to me that in that environment, if it goes just a little bit further than it already has, your boss, never mind being faceless, might not even be human. It might be entirely algorithm driven, which is potentially a disturbing thought.
Yeah, I mean, these are all issues that, again, the STUC is alive to. I think the whole issue of automation is one, that whole industry 4.0, the digitalisation of work, the way that so many of our jobs, we've got buses in the northeast of England that the drivers are effectively teaching the bus how to drive itself for the future. Yeah. We've got, tens of thousands of call centre jobs in jeopardy if AI continues to progress at the rate it has been progressing. These are real and serious issues, and that's where, some of the big economic questions around hours of work, around things like the four-day working week, and how working people share in the wealth that's created by business. Some of these bigger, wider economic arguments are arguments that we are very much getting into the debate around, because we have to think about a sustainable way forward for our economy where people can get dignity from work and work is sustainable.
In fact, I've just been writing about that phenomenon of wealth being pulled away from workers and workers not seeing the increasing share of income based on their productivity over the last several years. Folk are subscribed to the Commonweal newsletter. You'll see that article tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's a very real problem where companies, especially larger companies, are pulling that wealth away from the people who are generating that wealth.
Absolutely. I think that's a huge problem, and that links into the whole cost of living crisis that we're seeing at the moment. We've actually got an economic system that is designed to transfer wealth to the rich and to big business, where we should be redistributing wealth to working people and to poorer communities. That is not what the economy that we live in and experience right now is set up to do. So there are huge questions there. We've had decades of standards of living falling while we've had a lack of real investment by business. And, a financialisation of our economy where the profits are simply sucked out of our economy by the super rich. So, these problems just don't lead to a sustainable outcome for anyone. And we're beginning to see that getting really tough for people on the ground right now.
Yeah, and again, that pulls into the whole argument around automation, where if productivity is being driven more and more by robots rather than workers, then who is benefiting from that productivity? It's often the people with the capital to buy and maintain those robots rather than the labourers, rather than the workers.
Absolutely, yep.
Now, one thing that that has been sort of pushing back against trade unions, and it's often seen as an American phenomenon, but I want to see just how prevalent it is in Scotland as well, is direct anti-union activities by employers. One common line, quite proudly put out by companies like Amazon, is that the company would prefer there wouldn't be, their workers are not unionized because they would prefer a direct relationship with their employees. What does that actually mean in practice for those employees and for the protection of their workers' rights?
So, you know, that's definitely a phenomenon that we have seen in Scotland. I personally was involved in a number of organising campaigns in my old post with the Unite trade union. I worked in our organising and leverage department, where often we were involved in unionising workers, where we had some pretty anti-union employers to deal with. And, you know, they brought out the playbook on union busting, imported directly from America with the consultants to go with it, and, you know, got involved in deliberately trying to attack the trade union organisation that was emerging. Or, you know, I've also seen examples of where long-term and existing trade union agreements have been directly undermined by employers who no longer wish to engage in collective bargaining. And I think that it's something we need to be alive to as a movement, and we need to deal with. The best way to deal with it, I can think of one example where we had a 700-strong workforce, and we simply sent them out the prospectus of the consultants who were the union busters, and it was pretty much the playbook. And we sent it to all the members so they could see what was coming. Here are the steps they're going to go through to try and, you know, break your trust in each other and your trust in collective organisation, and then pointed out for them every time another, you know, lever was pulled by the employer. But, you know, we need to make sure that a lot of the research that is out there comes to the fore. It's absolutely proven that workers who are in unionised workplaces have better pay, better conditions of work, better health and safety, and that, you know, by far the most effective way to get a good worker voice in the workplace is through collective bargaining. There is international, worldwide research that shows this. The Scottish Government has actually signed up to that being the most effective form of worker voice. And it needs to be understood that employers who are trying to break unions or stop or put fear into a group of workers for trying to form a union are only doing it because they care more about their bottom line than they do about their own workers.
Yeah, and there's a wealth of documentaries out there that follow the story of those anti-union activities. I recently watched a very good one fly in the wall documentary about an American company who was going through exactly that process, and in the end they didn't win the fight to unionize their workforce, but it was interesting that as things developed from there, the former president of the company, who was himself then ousted as part of the power play, kind of turned around and said, yeah, I was wrong on that one, I can see what's happening now.
Well, we've dealt with recognition ballots where they've flown in, you know, the global vice president to tell the workforce that their plant would be closed within the next 2 years if they chose to vote for becoming a unionised workforce. Luckily, they did vote to become a unionised workforce, even in the face of that. But that's the sort of level of threat that sometimes is, you know, deployed. And even this week, tomorrow night, I'll be outside the Yodo depot in Bells Hill. Because there's been, you know, in the view of ourselves and GMB, an attempt by the management there to undermine union organisation. We've had a health and safety rep sacked there. We believe unfairly, and we believe it's directly linked to fears that the company has around the union trying to organise the delivery drivers there. So, you know, this is a very current and ongoing battle that takes place out there, I'm afraid.
Although it's one that, as you say, you have been helping to win. So can you give us a few examples of some of the victories that trade unions have won in Scotland recently?
Yeah, I mean, I can give you numerous examples. I think the thing that I would say to you, though, is that, you know, it is that whole day in, day out, reps every day are making a difference. So whether that's, you know, stopping someone from going through an unfair disciplinary process to making sure that a group of their employees get the, you know, the training that they need to carry out a job. During the pandemic, we saw numerous examples of reps fighting tooth and nail to make sure that their workers got the correct PPE. And, you know, unions were really, really vocal in making sure that if things weren't being done properly, that whistleblowing was taking place and that, you know, we were enforcing on the ground the guidance that government was putting out in the corridors of power, sort of thing. But, you know, just recently we saw a group of workers up in Dundee University successfully defend cuts that their employer were trying to make to their pension scheme. We've seen the AIMI workers across Glasgow who provide janitorial and cleaning services to Glasgow schools win a massive pay victory when they unionised and for the first time threatened strike action, looking for pay parity with directly employed public sector workers. We've seen the RMT and the other rail unions in the run-up to the COP successfully used the leverage of the COP in their dispute around pay with ScotRail and get a good victory out of that. And, you know, these are all really good examples, but that is just the tip of the iceberg. The fact is that when workers come together and stand together and take collective action, 9 times out of 10, they're going to get a win out of it. And they'll certainly get improvements to where they would have been had they not decided to come together and use that collective power.
So to take from that and go to an even higher level, as you say, that goes from right down to the individual actions up to national scale, how closely does the Scottish Government listen to the STUC and other individual member unions? Have your views managed to feed through into government policy?
Well, I think they do. I would always say not enough.
Yes.
Not as much as I would like them to. However, you know, we have to be fair and say that the one thing Scottish Government does give trade unions is a seat at the table. And, you know, we have the opportunity to feed into, you know, so for example, at the moment, I'm sitting on the advisory council for the strategy for economic transformation that the government's putting in place. Now, do I think I'm going to get an STUC people's recovery policy out of that, you know, right across the board? No, I don't. But do I think that the fact that we've been feeding in the views of the trade union movement will make it better than it might have been? Yes, I do. And, you know, similarly, when you look at the work that we've done with Scottish Government around the Fair Work Agenda, around making sure that, you know, the Scottish Government have a £13 billion procurement budget and a budget that supports businesses, you know, that they use to commission and procure. We've been making a lot of headway in making sure that, you know, the fair work aspect of that is checked with employers. Do I think the fair work aspects that we've put in place need to go further? Of course I do. I want to see even stronger teeth on it. I want to see it apply to even more areas of government support. But have we made some headway on it? Yes, we've made some headway on it. And I guess that's the constant battle we're in. You know, again, around public sector pay, we push hard around government's budgets and around pay for public sector workers. We don't always get everything we want, but have we made some positive headway? Yes, we have.
As a campaigning lobbyist myself, I always almost make a joke of saying to government, if you do give me everything that I want, I'll find something else.
Completely, you know, and I would be unabashed in making the very same, you know, particularly at the moment when so many of our members we know are going through real economic hardship. And, you know, one thing that we're always saying to government is it's great having all these policies. It's wonderful that you've got a Fair Work Minister. But what difference is that actually making to workers on the ground? And we do grow impatient, you know. If you look at the care service, for example, we put A whole range of recommendations through around collective bargaining for that sector, the need to push pay up. The report into the care sector was actually launched about 3 years ago, and we are still pushing to see the changes being made on the ground. So it's great to produce reports and have these different forums and win the debate in the forum, but we actually need it to translate into real action on the ground, and that's where we're growing impatient.
Especially as we look at the care sector and we look at the prospect of a national care service. So
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm sure we'll both be standing together calling for national collective bargaining for carers if and when that's launched.
Completely.
Now, on that, on the topic of the future, what campaigns are SDUC working on just now, or what are you looking towards for your next big push?
Well, the National Care Service, funnily enough, is a big priority area for us, but we are also looking at, the forthcoming local government elections, and looking at what more can be done by local authorities around things like the municipalisation of buses and taking control of our public transport systems locally, which we think would be a key part of transitioning to a green economy. We're also looking at funding for local services and all of those things that fit into the local government basket, and just more widely, the need for local government itself to be more appropriately funded by Scottish Government, because they deliver a really key range of services, particularly to vulnerable people. But we're also obviously looking at the whole just transition area, and the need to transition to a green economy. But that needs to be a transition where workers' voices are at the heart of it, and where there's going to be a proper plan for high quality unionised jobs. Again, if you look at things like the retrofitting of housing and how we make our homes more fuel efficient, we'd like to see local authorities taking the lead on that and be funded to directly employ workers to carry out that sort of work, so that it becomes a benefit for local communities on the jobs front, as well as tackling fuel poverty. So these are just some of the big areas that we're looking at. But I think top of our agenda right now is very much the cost of living crisis that we're facing, and the need to really mobilise ordinary people, to fight back around that. Because what has been offered by government, both at Scottish and UK level, is not good enough. So, people are going to have to stand up and fight for some real and radical changes to how our energy systems are operated. So we are trying to put back on the agenda that whole debate about the public ownership of things like energy, transport, and other essential services.
Everything I've said about nationalised energy has been said a dozen times now, so I won't bring that up again. But I have one final question. It's such an obvious question that I forgot to think about it until we started chatting today. If I or one of our listeners is not currently unionised and is looking at the vast spread of different unions and doesn't know which union that would be best for them to join, or doesn't know how to go about getting a group of their fellow employees to collectivize and join a union, where would I start? How do I get that advice?
Well, very much, I would say contact the STUC. We can and we do often give that sort of advice to workers and put them in touch with an appropriate trade union for their industry. The bottom line is, if you're sitting in a workplace where you feel you're not getting fairly treated and you don't have enough say over your pay and conditions, then the best way to do something about that is to join together with your colleagues and get into the appropriate union and get that support to start to take forward your issues in a collective way. And we do a lot of work with our affiliate unions to make sure that workers are given the appropriate advice and support to help them take that forward.
Right. And I will stick a link to the SDU website in the description of this podcast. So if anyone is thinking about joining a union, please follow that link and do it. Get organized. Well, thank you, Roz. That has been a fascinating chat. Thank you for coming on to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks, Craig, for having me.
And I just want to finish off, as I always do, by reminding folk that Commonweal as an organisation is entirely funded by our supporters, who donate an average of £10 a month. We don't get government money. We don't get corporate grants. We don't even have adverts on our website. We are entirely supported by ordinary folk like yourselves. So if you want to keep supporting our policies, keep supporting our campaigns, and keep supporting this podcast, then there's a donate button in the, a link to our donate page in the description of this podcast. Thank you for coming on, for listening to the show. Please share it. Please talk about it among your friends. Please send it to anyone you can think of who might be interested. And please come back next week.